The tagline for her new book could be, "Life is too short to gather in the traditional Martha Stewart way." At least that's how Priya Parker concisely summed up her new book about how we gather and how our get-togethers are lacking somehow in quality and substance. So here we are together on The Morning Show, one example of a gathering right now. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Priya Parker is the founder of Thrive Labs, where she helps activists, elected officials, educators, corporate executives, and philanthropists learn how to create transformative gatherings. She's author of the new book, The Art of Gathering, How We Meet and Why It Matters. And she joins us from NPR's headquarters there in Washington. Priya, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a treat to be here.
So why do so many of our meetings and conferences and even our friendly parties leave us feeling blah, disconnected?
I think one of the main reasons that we tend to not have memorable gatherings is because for decades we've been told to value things over people when preparing our gatherings. And so when I set out to write this book, I interviewed over 100 different gatherers from all walks of life. So a rabbi, a Cirque du Soleil choreographer, a photographer who gets 7 minutes with a head of state and has to figure out in those 7 minutes how to quickly kind of switch the dynamic so that the head of state kind of shows a face or takes off a mask that they wouldn't necessarily want to see the world, have the world to see. And I asked each of them, what creates a transformative gathering? And none of them said the flowers or the recipes or the, or the candles. Those all kind of can help create ambiance. But basically, for decades, we've been told that we should be prepping the canapés and the crudités. And we've kind of forgotten what to actually do when people are in the room live. How do you actually create connection once people are in front of you?
Why does the way we gather matter so much? Why does the way we gather matter so much?
It matters because we spend our days and lives in gatherings. You know, we go from baby showers to classrooms to back to school nights to, boardrooms and weddings and finally funerals. And I think in part because we're doing it all of the time, we've kind of gone on autopilot when we come together. And the way we gather influences the way we think about what's possible. It affects how we make decisions. It shapes culture. It makes us feel less lonely or more lonely. And because we don't think of it as kind of a thing, we don't think of gatherings as something we can actually improve. And I come to this world not as an events planner or a chef. I can guarantee you I'm a terrible chef. But as a conflict resolution facilitator. And I take that lens in this book to basically look at how do you actually improve and set the conditions so that when you are bringing people together, the experience that they have is memorable, is magical, and moves people in some way.
I was really, it was fun to read the part where you put yourself out there in showing how you have failed in just a run-of-the-mill dinner party, just bringing some people together. And you thought, I'll just be chill about this. I'll just put them into the room and they can kind of fend for themselves. And then you realized that wasn't working out so well.
Yes. So one of the things I've come to find is that chill, the idea of chill or kind of, laying back and being relaxed about everything. And I don't mean not anxious. I just mean, not taking care of people. It's been terrible advice for our gatherings. The moment I wrote about in the book is a dinner party that I was hosting with my husband. And we invited 10 people over to our home, and I really wanted it to go well. I was nervous. And I wanted to look cool. I wanted to look like one of those, effortless hosts that everything just, gels when they walk in. And so everybody came into the room, and we offered them a drink. They sat around the living room, and the energy was very low, and it was very awkward. And I was thinking, oh, dear, what is happening here? And in trying to be cool and not look like I cared too much, I didn't give my guests enough guidance as to what to actually do. And a guest actually pulled me aside and said, "Will you please introduce us to each other?"
you didn't even introduce them. You just really let them fend for themselves.
Yeah, and I just kind of, I mean, some of the context in that gathering was some of them knew who each other were or, you know, had kind of met a few times. And so I just thought I didn't want to look like I was kind of doing too much or being too formal. And in trying to kind of look that way, I under-equipped them. And then I over course corrected, and I when we sat down at the dinner, I then, you know, dinged my glass and thanked them all for being here, and then I tried to introduce them, but because I hadn't prepared, I was kind of fumbling. I was getting the data, you know, their stories wrong. George is from Tennessee. No, I grew up in Georgia, you know. And you know, one of the things that I realized over the course of writing this book and in watching a lot of different gatherings is that the best gatherings are when the host is comfortable with his or her power. And one of the companies that does this, I think, beautifully in the world, in the U.S. at least, is a company called the Alamo Draft House. Have you ever been to an Alamo Draft House?
I know them. They're where you watch a movie and you can eat food at the same time. I think they're based in Texas.
They're based in Texas, and they now have different draft houses around the country.
Yeah.
Maybe one can come to Wisconsin. And like every movie theater, they, at the beginning of a show, at the film, will have a kind of a funny ad that says turn off your phones, no texting. AMC and Lowe's, you know, they all have that also. But Alamo is different because they then say if you do text or if you see somebody texting, you can put up a card in front of you. No one knows it'll be you because you also order food on that card, and you can say, hey, this person is texting. And then the Alamo staff will come out and give the person who's texting a warning. And if they don't put the phone away or they bring it out again or they're talking, they'll actually kick them out. And they actually kick them out. I can attest to it. And what's fabulous about this is that they're willing to actually enforce the kind of the rules and the norms that they set out to create. They're being fantastic gatherers because they're willing to actually protect the other guests rather than putting it on us as movie viewers. You know, you sit at a movie and someone's talking behind you and you kind of give them an evil eye and then they don't be quiet. So then do you escalate it, right? Do you shush them? No, okay. Then do you actually, you know, escalate it? And in most movie theaters, it takes, unless you get in a physical fight, you know, security will come out. But they kind of, they abdicate their role of hosts by putting it on the viewers to kind of self-correct each other. And the Alamo understands that its core purpose as a gatherer is to bring the magic of the movies to people in real life. And they realize that they can only do that if they actually enforce, not just sit back once people arrive.
So it's not just a courtesy. It is actually being a host, being very much an enforcer and saying, this is how this gathering is going to work. So, you know, planning a meeting or a party, it's a lot of logistics, and those are important for sure. But you say that creating a gathering is a human challenge, not just a logistical one. Why is that?
It's a human one because even when you get all of the logistics right, and the logistics are important, so I'm not saying they're not important, but you can have the most beautiful food, or if it's a meeting, you can have the, you know, perfect PowerPoint with the perfect font and all of the headlines all match and, you know, the numbers are of the slides are correct. And then people come into the room, and if you don't actually think about and focus on connecting them to each other and you connecting them with a host, it doesn't really matter what your content is if they don't actually feel that they belong there. And so we often actually forget to connect people to each other. It sounds kind of obvious because we just sort of hope for the best when people come into the room. But I looked at a number of different conferences that focused on actually connecting their guests to each other. So I'll give an example of a conference that I love. I haven't been to, but I interviewed the founders. It's called Spark Camp. It was founded by five friends in the media industry, and they wanted to kind of disrupt or kind of reboot, you know, how we do conferences. And so it's a weekend program. You Friday night to Sunday afternoon, 70 people. They want it to be intimate but still kind of buzzy with energy. And they had to figure out, okay, how are we going to get these people to kind of know who's in the room quickly? And they wanted to have a dynamic where people brought their whole selves. They, you know, I'm a beekeeper. I also might have be an executive at a company. And I also have a stepchild. You know, I have all of these parts of me. But that doesn't usually happen at conference. So a Friday night, they decided to do introductions of the entire conference themselves. And so they gather together after dinner, sometimes before dinner. 70 people in a room, and the five hosts basically read aloud short, whimsical introductions. And if you're in the audience and you hear yourself described, you're told to stand up. And so what this does, and they did this for 70 people, so this person met their husband at a beekeeping convention. They are a mother of two, and they are one of the leading thinkers in contagious disease.
But couldn't that be tedious, laborious?
Well, yes, it can. But the way that they do it is that they include facts about people that are of multiple sides of them. So they're curious about people's many selves. But the second thing that's brilliant is that they figured out no one wants to kind of miss their own bio. And so, eyes are darting around the room thinking, who is this? Who is this? Who is this? And sometimes multiple people stand up at the same description, which becomes quite hilarious. And they have to figure out who is it about. And basically, in a group dynamic, you have to understand what people are interested in. And most people are interested in, the topic, perhaps, of what you're doing. But they also are really interested in other people as well as being seen themselves.
You also know that there are some sweet spots in terms of how many people are gathered together for whether it is a meeting or a party. And you break down some numbers for us on these ideal. It's not just about how many people can fit into the room and what the fire code is. There are some real interesting dynamics when you have different numbers of people. What are those numbers?
Yes, thank you for that. So first I'll just say I define a gathering as anytime three or more people come together for a purpose. And so six is kind of the first size of a group that is great for intimate dialogue, and that could be in a context of a work meeting, a church meeting, or friends gathering. Six is hard if it can't really carry dead weight. So if one or two people are kind of checked out, it's hard to kind of lift the group, through that experience. Churches tend to have groups of six to make the church, these mega churches make the church kind of feel smaller. Prayer groups tend to be groups of six. And then the next number tends to be between 8 and 12. 8 and 12, I'm a facilitator, and whenever we create group dialogues with people in conflict, the groups are always between 8 and 12 people. It's big enough to kind of have the energy and multiple diverse perspectives, but it's still small enough that if it's facilitated well or led well, everybody has a chance to talk. And then after that, kind of 20 to 30 is great for buzzy, intimate parties. Mm. The numbers that are kind of interesting above that are 120 to 150. So weddings and wedding planners that I spoke with tend to say that those are, beautiful, kind of the word they use is tribal weddings, in the sense that you have your whole tribe there. But it's still small enough that it's possible that over the course of a night, everybody can see everybody else and if you design it well, can make eye contact with everybody else. In anthropology, there's a number called Dunbar's number, which is sort of the size of a tribe, and the number of people that you can actually remember and have a real relationship with. And they say it's about 150.
Priya Parker is a group facilitator with a background in conflict resolution. She's founder of Thrive Labs. Her new book is The Art of Gathering, How We Meet and Why It Matters. You can join in with your questions, your perspectives, 800-642-1234. Do you feel disconnected during work meetings? Are you planning a meeting or a festival, perhaps a reunion or party? What is your goal behind this? What challenges are you running into? You can call in, you can email ideas@wpr.org. We'll get back to the conversation in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. A survey in 2015 called The State of Enterprise Work found that wasteful meetings were employees' top obstacle to getting work done. And when we're hanging out with friends, our feelings aren't any more optimistic. That's according to a 2013 report on friendships, finding that 3/4 of respondents were unsatisfied with their relationships. These stats are part of the framework in the new book, The Art of Gathering. We're talking about it here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Author Priya Parker stays with us. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do social gatherings make you feel insecure or uncomfortable? Does it have to do with a lack of meaning in the gathering itself, or is it a lack of structure or the hosting? You can call in or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's talk a little moment here, Priya, about workplace meetings. We've all been in that, quote, that meeting where we aren't using our time well, we aren't actually coming together. What can we do to make these meetings better? And what does better really mean?
Yeah, it's a great question. The first thing we can all do is ask, what is the purpose of this meeting? And particularly in the workplace, we tend to follow the rituals of meeting. There's a set meeting, so we fill in the time. Or we assume that anything and everything under the sun requires a meeting. So my first piece of advice is actually in the workplace to meet less. And when you start meeting less, when you do meet, it's much more likely that it will be for a good purpose. One of the things that we tend to do in our work meetings is solve everything through a meeting. And I often say, if only host a meeting if what you need to discuss could only be discussed in person. If not, put it in an email. The second thing I'll say is that we tend to skip over what our purpose is. And so one very simple thing you can do first is think about how you actually invite people. Give your meeting or whatever it is, a conference or workshop, a name. Is it a networking session? Is it a brainstorming session? Is it a lab? Don't call it a meeting. Think about what it actually is and give it a name, because the way you name your meeting primes people to show up in a certain way. The second thing is don't make your invitation just an Outlook invitation, sending an invitation as a calendar invite. Don't make your invitation only a logistical information carrier. Think about why you're having these people meet. Name your meeting, whatever it is. And then in the beginning, think about how you actually open. Don't start with logistics. Start with purpose. And spend some time connecting people, even if it's just a minute. So one study show that when surgeons gather, they, not surprisingly, want to kind of get to the subject at hand. They want to start cutting. It's literally life or death stakes. And one study showed that when they take time ahead of time to actually just introduce themselves in the surgical unit, everybody, the nurses, the assistants, physical assistants, the surgeons, error rates drop by 35%. And that's because when people in a group speak, they each speak their name, and they do a couple other things with the checklist, but they say their name ahead of time, they are more likely, when something starts to go wrong, as in surgery it often does, they're more likely to speak up earlier. In part because surgical teams are hierarchical, as most work groups are. And so if you set the norm right in the beginning that everybody here needs to be here, and you give them an opportunity to say something, it actually changes the course of the meeting or and the content, and it makes everybody actually more effective.
But you also have to break the mold, because meetings happen a certain way, like they always have. They've got history, they've got baggage. So how do you break the mold?
Absolutely. The first simple one is to meet in a different place than you usually meet. And that could, in a building or an office, it could literally just be in a different office. It could be on a different floor. You don't have to kind of go to Disney World to disrupt people. And you can also disrupt a pattern by physically changing the setup of the room. So one of the characters I interviewed in the book is a woman named Wendy Woon. She runs the education department at the MoMA in New York, the Museum of Modern Art. And she teaches a number of courses. And on the first day of her class in museum education, you walk into her classroom, and it's a normal classroom, chairs, big slide in the front, and people walk in, the students walk in, and she's tangled, she's kind of piled all of the chairs in a huge, almost like bonfire-like pile. And the students walk in, and they're confused, and she doesn't say anything. And basically, slowly, they kind of have to figure out together, like, what are we supposed to do here? And they have to, is it a piece of art? Are we supposed to go get our own chair? Once we pick up that chair in a pile, should we set it up in lines or circles? And so she disrupts the format very quickly because we all expect to walk into a classroom and see rows of chairs. So when you think of, or a boardroom and see kind of, you know, mahogany desks all in a square with, you know, water bottles, you know, Evian water bottles on paper napkins on the front. Mm-hmm. If you just simply take out the tables and put a chairs in there, people will behave differently.
Let's take a call now. Let's go to Bill waiting in Madison. Hi, Bill.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to mention that your guest talked about the importance of the host exercising his or her authority, so to speak, in bringing people together and so forth. And that reminded me of a principle in rituals, which she also mentioned, that it involves, well, one anthropologist defined it as doing things not entirely scripted by the performer, that is, acceding to the authority, sort of the ritual. And I wanted to mention, well, she mentioned the protocols in surgery playing a role of that kind. And I wanted to mention that a very interesting to me little essay by a German philosopher named Joseph Pieper called Leisure, the Basis of Culture, in which he argues the main point of the essay is that cultures depend on festival, and festival depends on ritual. Actually, he says ritual sacrifice. And so I'm thinking that just wanted to underline that theme that seems to be emerging in your conversation.
Bill, thank you so much for bringing that to the table. Priya, what do you make of that?
I love this question. It's a very astute observation. You know, gatherings have power when they become ritualized. But when the ritual doesn't match the purpose, the ritual starts to become routine and meaningless. And so festivals are this, you know, beautiful kind of experience when done well because of the way they gather, because of the way they prime people, because often they're ritualistic in the sense that people go to the same festival year after year after year. They become deeply, deeply meaningful to us. And you know, this idea that that culture depends on festival and festival depends on ritual, many of the reasons that I believe our gatherings in all sorts of contexts are lackluster is because we have forgotten in some ways how to actually create ritual. And when you look at the gatherings in the country that are getting huge followings, they're basically ritualizing experiences. So, for example, Soul Cycle. Or Tough Mudders. Tough Mudders is an obstacle course that kind of takes the marathon to an extreme where you swim through literally buckets of ice or you have to jump over an electric fence and you're likely to get electrocuted. But they do it in a way where it's a collective experience. There's no way you could actually go through this obstacle course without the help of other strangers. And the way the Tough Mudder starts their weekends, you know, in a marathon, every individual person, New York Marathon, you have your own kind of warm-up rituals. Maybe you have your special stinky socks or your special headband. But the Tough Mudders have created a ritual where at the beginning, everybody, all, you know, the thousands or hundreds of people who are going to do this three-day or day-long kind of marathon, they take a collective oath together. And that's a ritualistic act. And in the oath, they actually say, I don't have it in front of me, but they say something like, I don't whine, and I pledge to help others in this because this is a collective act. And so they prime themselves to help each other to compete together and realize that this is actually something that we can only do with one another. And people are obsessed with Tough Mudders. I mean, they get tattoos of Tough Mudders. And part of this, to what the caller said, is that when a ritual matches the purpose, it can be extraordinarily powerful. And inversely, when the ritual no longer matches the purpose, so you go to your 12th or 15th baby shower and everybody's playing the exact same game and you're thinking, you know, I'm getting married at 36 and I don't really, you know, need help buying stuff and I'm not really loving these games, but I do want my community to come together. Why does my baby shower have to look like this? All of a sudden, we actually need to begin thinking, how can we start changing some of those rituals so that they actually transform us, which is the purpose of ritual?
Looking more deeply on the topic of festivals, here in Wisconsin, there are festivals galore, and they are at all times of the year, but especially in the summer. Some festivals are hurting. Some festivals are struggling to stay afloat, or whether they have merit anymore, whether they matter. What advice do you have when it comes to these festivals, these huge gatherings, and staying relevant?
Yeah, it's a beautiful question. I would begin with purpose. And, you know, what I would say to any festival gatherer is look back and ask, why did we originally begin? What is our origin story? What is our what is our myth around why we originally began? And it may be we began because we wanted, it was a time of, you know, summer harvest, and it was a functional, I'm making this up, but it was a functional reason. We needed each other to actually harvest together. And over time, we no longer, you know, we got machines to do that, but we still like to come together. But the functional part of it is kind of over. And over time, you know, kids moved away and people got busy, and we no longer really, you know, people are kind of bored with this format. And what I would say is when we get attached to the form of the festival, we have to have beer here, or we have to have a specific type of cheese, or we have to have people stand 7 meters apart. That's when you're likely to start losing meaning. But when you go back to the DNA, okay, we started this because we actually need each other. Okay, that's still relevant. What do we need each other today for, if not the harvest? And then begin redesigning the format to answer that question.
We're talking about the new book, The Art of Gathering, How We Meet and Why It Matters. Priya Parker is our guest. You can join in 800-642-1234. What kind of host are you when you lead meetings or throw parties? Are you perhaps organizing a festival right now? What are the challenges you have? And what is the approach you take? How do you make that festival, that reunion, that party matter? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Priya, one idea you explore in the book is this role of ushering during a gathering, and you describe a political event in which thousands of people were ushered into a space to wait for Bernie Sanders to speak, and political organizers didn't use this technique. So before we talk about this moment, though, can you explain for us, walk us through this experience of ushering and what that is?
Absolutely. So your event and your gathering, it begins before you think it begins. Any gathering begins at the moment of discovery of the guest. And what I mean by that is your gathering begins the moment that your guest discovers that this is a thing in their future. And one of the things we do is we underhost between the moment of invitation to the moment they show up at the door. And one of the things I'm arguing is that you're actually hosting and priming and setting them up to behave and show up in a certain way. And I talk about this idea of ushering, which is the moment from which they enter into the door, or if you're walking into a stadium, or if you're going to a picnic, you know, the second you walk into the grass, those kind of moments before the formal proceedings, quote-unquote, begin, but after they've come in the door, the kind of milling around time, if you will. Mm. And the best, you know, the when I spoke with these various gatherers all over the world, they all understood that that not only wasn't time that, most people think that that time doesn't count. And actually, that time is extraordinarily important, because those are the first few moments where everyone's looking around and wondering what the norms are here. I mean, it's all below the surface. It's implicit. Should I, do I belong here? Do I want to be here? Can I be jokey? Can I talk about the fact that I'm divorced? Or should I try to be as buttoned up as possible? Can I show a little bit of my tattoo? Or is it better to kind of roll my sleeves down? What is happening here? Which part of myself can I show? And the best host understands that that's the time that you can actually start hosting, talking, you know, getting off of your tech or getting out of the kitchen or wherever you are, kind of managing the things and showing up and welcoming and honoring your guests, but also connecting them to each other. And the example I gave in the book was this Bernie Sanders rally in Philadelphia. I wasn't there, but I had somebody who was there, and they kind of reported back. I have spies everywhere. They reported back that for 3 hours, because of security protocol, there were thousands and thousands of people in this 10,200-seat auditorium or stadium, kind of waiting around for the candidate to show up. And in my mind, My goodness, what an incredible opportunity. You have 10,000 people live in the flesh waiting and, took a day off work or got a babysitter or brought their children. What incredible time to have and use that time. But because in the organizer's mind, that time didn't count, it was categorized as waiting time. They didn't use it. They didn't use it to have people turn to a stranger and talk, in that case, about, their experience on the other side of the economic divide or why they believe Bernie is the solution to, the country's ails, to actually build a movement.
And so what can we learn from a gathering that doesn't incorporate this really important preliminary part of pre-gathering, if you will?
Yeah, is that you are gathering from the moment that you send out the invitation. I'll give another example that I love. And that, frankly, it doesn't have to be complex. So Michel Lapris is a choreographer for Cirque du Soleil, and he's incredibly talented at creating these kind of amazing epic Cirque du Soleil shows. And I interviewed him for this book. And at the end, I just said, how do you gather in your own life? Like how, this sounds extremely complicated and magical, but I don't know if I could do this. And he said, I'll give you an example. Last year, I was touring a lot and I just wanted to be home with my friends. And so I sent out an invitation. I just literally sent an email and I said, I'm coming home next week. I don't even have my tree decorated, but I'd love for you to come to have a kind of Christmas end of the year party at my home. Please just send me 2 photos of moments of happiness over the past year. That's all I ask. Come and just send me 2 photos. Simple invitation. It was not printed out. It was not, gold leafed. He thought about it for, a minute and a half. Everybody did send photographs. And when they walked in that night, and there were about 12 people there, and many of them didn't know each other, they walked in and the tree was beautifully decorated with their photos, with their moments of happiness. And they were delighted. He honored them. They were reminded of their moments of happiness. And because he primed them, before they even showed up, they had to go rummaging through their, Google Photos or their phone or, wherever you keep your photos these days and think back themselves. What were the 2 moments of happiness?
Oh, so they had to have some skin in the game as well, if you will.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. And then they had things to talk about with each other. So priming doesn't have to be expensive. It's free. I mean, part of this is like, this is not about fish knives. This is not about, Times New Roman font on a PowerPoint presentation. This is deeply thinking very, this is just thoughtfulness about what is the purpose of my gathering and how can I connect people to it.
Let's bring in Suzelle joining us from Wauwatosa. Hi, Suzelle.
Hi. The book sounds wonderful.
It is. Go ahead.
I am a Unitarian Universalist minister, and we do a lot of gathering in my congregation, obviously every week and other times as well. And I love some of the things that you're suggesting. We also have different ways of doing rituals, seasonal rituals, weddings, memorials that do keep it fresh because we do go back to the deeper understanding of what the ritual is about, not just the form, but what's the meaning? And it sounds like that's what your book's all about, is going for that deeper meaning, particularly if you want a ritual to be transforming and kind of facilitate that true meeting of the people who are engaged. So I'm not sure I have anything big to offer, just that
Suzelle, is it difficult for you to keep seasonal rituals in your congregation afresh, alive, transforming, to keep that spark there?
No, actually, it's not difficult at all, in part because our particular tradition is very open to change and new ideas, so we don't have a fixed scripture or creed or anything, so we have a lot of freedom in the way that we observe or celebrate rituals. So so there's always a creative element or a way to say, God, we've been doing this thing the same way. Let's freshen it up. Let's change it up. Let's look at where our people are now. How are they responding to what's happening in the world? And how do we create a way for them to engage with their hearts and minds, no matter what's happening in the broader culture. So, but it sounds like I should read the book.
Suzelle, thank you.
Great stuff.
Thanks so much for bringing that to the table. Priya, what would you say to Suzelle?
First, I would say, in listening to what you what you shared with us, it sounds like you are already creating meaningful rituals, and in all contexts and all communities, the dance in making rituals matter is knowing what parts should be replicated over and over and over again and not changed, and where can things be refreshed for a new day. And I'll give an example from an Indian context. So in Indian weddings, in Hindu weddings, there's a traditional part of the ceremony, of the ritual, where it's called the feras, where you walk around, the groom and the bride walk around a fire 7 times and say a number of different kind of vows every time. And in the Indian context, in the Hindu context, particularly in North India, where my mother is from, my father is from Waterloo, Iowa, so I'm half Indian, half white American. That image, that moment, is sort of plastered on the wall of like every family's living room. It is this iconic, important moment, the feras. That's like when you really get married. Over the last couple decades, there's been a lot of kind of grumbling, op-eds, public conversation that these feras are actually quite misogynistic. They kind of put the weight of the marriage roughly on the woman. The woman is roughly broadly talking about her children as the primary role. And a number of women and men in India start feeling like, well, here are these feras. My mother, my grandmother, my great-grandmother all did it. And I feel belonging to the ritual of it. But the meaning of it neither does it relate to my actual life, nor does it relate to my vision or my values of what I believe I want my wedding to be, my marriage to be. Mm-hmm. And so there's been a huge debate, and people get very upset when you change a ritual, because on one hand, if you change the vows, there's some people in the group that says, well, that's not a wedding anymore. That's not a Hindu ceremony. They're doing something, but it's not a Hindu ceremony.
Disqualifying it.
Exactly. And there's others that think, my God, what an honoring of a tradition that you can keep the physical rounds but refresh it to a new age. Not only are you not honoring, you are deeply honoring, because you are thinking about the purpose of this ritual.
When we gather people together, do we set an intention for the event, whether it is in our own congregation or a meeting agenda? We're talking about the new book, The Art of Gathering, How We Meet, Why It Matters. You can join in with your questions for Priya Parker, 800-642-1234. What kind of host are you when you lead meetings or throw parties? Do you wish you had more meaningful conversations at your gatherings? Are you afraid of letting your guests down in some way? You can call in, email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the discussion after this break here on the Ideas Network. Author Priya Parker writes about the exit line as part of How to End a Gathering. Princeton grads walk through a gate at the end of their graduation ceremony, a gate that students are not to cross the threshold of until graduation, conforming to a tradition. Some yoga classes end with namaste. A good and meaningful closing doesn't conform to any particular rules or form. It's something you have to build yourself in keeping with the spirit of your gathering. It's up to you. The book is The Art of Gathering, How We Meet and Why It Matters. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Carolyn in Milwaukee. Hi, Carolyn.
Good morning.
Good morning. Go ahead.
Well, I was on the board of directors for a festival for many years, and the festival never changed. I ended up leaving the board because of it, because I was getting very frustrated by nothing ever changing. And this despite feedback from patrons that it would be nice to see, you know, more of one thing and less of another. How do you convince people that some change can be good without inherently changing the purpose and the focus of the celebration?
Carolyn, thanks. Priya, how do you do that?
You help them understand that sometimes change is actually a radical shift to get back to purpose. And So for, and the second thing I'd say is you try to figure out their fear. What's the fear behind what they, why they're saying no? I was speaking with organizers of a book festival, and they wanted to figure out how to connect their community more to each other in the book festival. Thousands of people go, and we got down to the kind of the minutia of how do they run every 60-minute session. And they start by having authors, you know, not rocket science. I mean, it's sort of obvious, but have authors talk or read. And I said, okay, so what if you spend the first 2 minutes, just 2 minutes, getting the 500 people in the room to turn to a stranger and just say, like, what brought you here? Or what does it mean to you? Were you born in the city, or do you consider yourself an immigrant to the city, even if it's from another city? Or what's the earliest book you can remember? And they love the idea. And then one of the organizers said, well, I feel uncomfortable taking 2 minutes. You can't take 2 minutes away from a Nobel laureate. You can't take 2 minutes away from a Pulitzer Prize. I mean, they've come all this way. And in there, I heard, you know, you kind of hear the fear and the behind the question. And so to keep kind of digging and ask what the actual fear is, and in that case, you know, to help them understand that if you don't, you know, if your true purpose is actually to connect, you know, to connect a community and have them come back over and over and over again, they actually need to model that in their, you know, in the gathering. One of my favorite examples in the book is a courthouse that paused to ask the radical question, what is the purpose of court? What is the purpose of the gathering of court? The Red Hook Community Justice Center, and they decided that for them, they were in a community in Red Hook, Brooklyn. It was suffering from a lot of violence, and the court system was not reducing the violence. And they thought, what if we could create a court proceeding where the intervention of court, when we actually have these people in a room, could not just transform the relationships but transform the community? What would that look like? And what that looked like was changing the physical structure of the courtroom, putting the judge Alex Calabrese not on a pedestal but at a small open desk, not making it adversarial necessarily, bringing social workers into the room, basically changing the rituals of court, which you know, to your question around festivals, and it sounds like with your as a board of directors, people were very 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 tied to the form of the festival, and then you know, and then you finally left to help them sometimes think of other examples that the form is not, you know, necessarily the sense of purpose. You need to step back and say, why are we doing this? And all gathering life, you know, all of group life is the delicate dance between the kind of the I and the we. When do you listen to, you know, what people are telling you, even if they have a different perspective than you? And also, what is the larger thing we can actually agree upon? And it sounds like, you know, for the festival, you were, you know, perhaps a canary in a coal mine. Sometimes it's helpful to, you know, look at other examples far-fetched from your field to say, hey, when they didn't listen, you know, this group died.
Carolyn, thanks. Let's go to Paul now in Milwaukee. Paul, hi.
Hello.
Hi. Are you there, Paul?
Yeah, I'm here. Hi. I'm a teacher in Milwaukee, and I teach high school health. And a mentor of mine years ago said, if it's not real, if it's not relevant, if it's not now, why are we teaching it? And it's been my challenge in my career to create an environment in a classroom where, okay, I'm assessing you, true, false, multiple choice, or can I put you into a scenario given some facts, given a skill that I want you to acquire or develop or understand. So when I did exams this year, I surprised all the kids when they walked in. The first part of it was a group activity, and they had to resolve and understand issues and what they would do in different scenarios. You're at a party, somebody's drunk, the law of consent. You are dealing with somebody drinking too much in the backyard, it's supposed to be at work. What do you know about, as you mentioned before, changing the function of a classroom today and helping the students, particularly our young people, to feel they're being recognized, what's going on in their world, and they want to discuss it, they want to share.
Paul, thank you. Priya, the classroom.
Paul, it's a beautiful question, and I just want to highlight a couple of things you said. First, you said, you know, I surprised them. So one thing, and this doesn't relate to the classroom only, is people love to be surprised, even adults. And that the thrill of when you kind of surprise people or the unexpected is they begin to actually behave differently because you're doing something differently. And the second thing you said is I really saw them. I saw, how do I treat them and let them see that I'm seeing them? You know, to me, gathering is an act of power, and it's also an act of love. And when you can use both of those in your classroom, it'll be a transformative classroom. I interviewed a number of teachers for this book, and all of them thought about different ways within the structure and requirements, you know, sometimes fiduciary, sometimes Board of Ed, what could they do to help delight students and help them learn. And in a number of cases, it was always not necessarily within the curriculum of what they had to teach, but like you, figuring out how they could experiment and delight in the moments that they did have control over. So one of the examples was a MIT professor of accounting, Sugata Rao Choudhury, and he, at the opening day of class, I went to MIT for business school, so I had the honor of experiencing this. He starts the class, you know, roll call or attendance is something every student teacher does, but it's usually either digital or they just read the names out loud. And he stood up and he put down a paper, and there's 90 students in a class sitting in front of him, and by memory, we've never met him before, by memory, he found each one of us and said our name out loud in front of everybody else.
Mm.
And in that moment, he both said, I'm brilliant, you should listen to me. But he also deeply honored us, and he captivated us, in part for the next rest of the year, because we knew that this guy cared about us.
Well, because we're short on time and our hour is about to come to a close pretty soon, how can we close our gatherings on a very high moment, in a powerful way?
So just like openings, don't close with logistics, and thank yous, do them second to last. Save the ending. You know, one of the things I like to say is all gatherings stop at some point, but allow your gathering to end. And ways to do that is to help people in small ways kind of reflect back of what happened here, and kind of prepare them to go back out into the world. And it can be very simple things. It can be if you had a night of stories, you know, you asked your guests to share toasts or stories of their life. It could be to say, you know, I loved it, particularly when Margaret shared the story of her grandfather discovering that box in the attic and realizing that actually after so many years, he never knew that he actually was Jewish. You know, and that's a real story of a dinner that I witnessed once. But it, you have power to shape people's memories of the experience at the end, and end with a story or an experience that allows people to remember, you know, what happened here, what's transpired here. And then as the exit line, as they leave, to do something at the walk them to the door. It can be very simple. Walk them to the door. Give them a box of, you know, hold a basket of like big chocolate bars and allow them to choose a chocolate bar as they leave. It's a simple thing my mother did at a birthday party she had recently. And, you know, 60 and 70-year-olds were sort of fighting over playfully chocolate like toddlers. Mm. And it was just delightful. So end well and think about how you want to close in a way that, again, honors and delights your guests and brings back to your purpose.
Well, Priya, this has been so lovely. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. Such a treat.
Priya Parker is the founder of Thrive Labs. She is the author of The Art of Gathering, How We Meet and Why It Matters. This hour of the morning show was produced by Brianne Chasso and Sarah Hopeful. Michael Derringer provided technical support. And this conversation is on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks so much for listening and for joining us. Thank you.